transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
On the show with us this week is sports columnist for the Montreal Gazette, Dave Stubbs, talking about the upcoming Summer Olympics happening in London, England. Dave has all the scoop about which countries are expected to take home a lot of medals and what athletes to be on the lookout for. We also chat with fashion blogger Nikki Lazina about the fall season and what we should be doing with our autumn wardrobes. Gina Lee is here with the Love Zone, and then we wrap things up with a remix from Demi Lovato, Give Your Heart a Break.
Capture your need for sound.
We're only a few weeks away from the London Summer Olympics kicking off, and you can feel the excitement in the air. Even if you don't consider yourself a sports junkie, there is something about the Olympics that get us all going. Maybe it's the fact that we get to cheer for athletes from our own country, and it gives us an amazing sense of national pride. To help us get ready for the games and to set the scene is sports columnist and feature writer for the Montreal Gazette, Dave Stubbs. Dave, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Kelly, thanks for having me.
Dave, in your opinion, why do you think so many people get hooked on watching the Olympics?
There's something I think very galvanizing about the Olympic Games, Kelly, and it's unfortunate almost for the high-performance amateur athletes around the world that for the most part, these people are hugely important to the lives of people in many countries for a couple weeks a year, and then they could basically perform again under cover of darkness. You will have athletes who will compete at World Cups, World Championships, events that very much in the eyes of the athletes are as important as the Olympic Games, but they don't have the cachet of the Olympics. And I guess it's because it's the five-ring circus, because it is so heavily publicized, because it is such an event. It's just one of those things that the athletes understand it. And we've had instances where athletes you've never heard about will suddenly appear at the Olympics and make a name for themselves, win a gold medal, and all of a sudden they're a household name, where other athletes who have been absolutely tremendous performers across the board throughout the season slip, fall for whatever reason. Perdita Felician hitting a hurdle. Jeremy Weatherspoon of Canada falling at the start of a 500-meter speed skating sprint. These things happen. These people are human beings, and unfortunately, when you fall on the world's largest stage, people sometimes will remember you for that more than all the good things you've done. So I have unbelievable respect and admiration for athletes at this level, because to try to imagine going into an event not just with the weight of your own expectations on your shoulders, but knowing that an entire country is sitting at home watching you, that's a pretty remarkable thing to be able to stand up to that pressure and do the job on the day.
Now, London is going to be your 13th Olympics. Are you as excited to go as you were on like the first or the fifth or the seventh time?
Yeah, absolutely, Kelly. They're all different. And I've spoken to a number of athletes who are going to their fourth. Canadian divers Emily Haymans and Alexandre Despatie are going to their fourth Olympics. There are some people who are going to their first, and this is a huge thrill for them. The athletes who are going back to their games for a second or a third or a fourth time, they pretty much know what to expect in the Olympic arena. There are not a lot of surprises that will be awaiting them there. But all that said, inevitably, there's just something that's around the corner, that maybe it's a bus that doesn't show up, maybe it's a meal that you eat that doesn't agree with you. I mean, there are all these variables. But to go to the games is a thrilling event. And when you go as a journalist, when you're sitting and you're working in the main media center and you'll have three or four reporters from Djibouti sitting around the corner from you yelling and screaming about some performance one of their track athletes had, and then you will have reporters from Norway on the other side saying we really shouldn't even bother being in the Summer Games because our strong athletes are in winter. It's an amazing United Nations that you go to cover. And the athletes love it because instead of being at a World Cup event and just sort of working with their own athletes, competing with athletes within their own sport, suddenly they're in the cafeteria, and one of the world's greatest high jumpers will be sitting at a table next to them, or you will have Prince Albert of Monaco in the Winter Games sitting, and he's a bobsleigh driver for Monaco, so he's sitting next to you. So they're really an amazing thing, and there's really nothing to compare. And the biggest regret that you have is you will go to bed having done 13 or 14 14 different stories or little hits a day, and you'll say, geez, you know, there were two other ones I really wish that I had the time to get to. But, you know, and then you do that for 14, 15, 16 days in a row working on adrenaline, there's really nothing to compare in sports writing, from my point of view, from sports journalism now, than covering the Olympics. They're an amazing event.
For an athlete that is going to the Olympics, and I know you mentioned some of them are going for their second or their third or their fourth time, is the first time that they go really like a warm-up, or are they expected to do well too? Because it almost seems like nerves are going to play a huge factor in their first time going to an Olympic Games.
Yeah, it depends, Cal. You know, you will have athletes who will go and they really will be at their peak. I mean, maybe they should have been or were knocking on the door of going to an Olympics 4 years previously. And so they are really in tremendous shape, almost in the peak of their athletic performance, their athletic prowess by the time they get to the games. For some, there are great expectations. For others, you go to the first games and it's just a matter of getting through it. It's experiencing it. And I don't think that anyone goes to the Olympics as a passenger. Athletes don't go there just to go and be sightseeing. Years. Used to be that an athlete would say, well, I made the Olympics. I've pretty much done what I have to do. Well, now, when these young men and women go to represent their countries, they want to go and they want to compete to the best of their ability. And some of the most compelling stories are the athletes who don't finish first or second or third, but they will finish up the track, or everyone will be out of the swimming pool before another athlete finishes. But it's the fact that that athlete has gotten to that, has made the qualifying standard, and then actually finishes their event. They're the ones sometimes who are really the most charismatic athletes and the most compelling stories to talk about.
Speaking of, I guess, the stories that we're going to all end up talking about, there's so many stories that seem to jump out at you. Like for the last Olympics or the last Summer Olympics, we'll just use Michael Phelps as an example. You know, he walked away with 8 gold medals. Who do you think are going to be the stories or the athletes that we talk about this time around?
Well, I think there'll be a couple of stories right off the bat, and the men's 100 meters on the track is always one of the marquee events. We have a world record holder and defending Olympic champion Usain Bolt of Jamaica, who at his own national trials was beaten in both the 100 and the 200 meters by a young man named Johan Blake. So Blake is one of those guys who could maybe knock off, he could beat Usain Bolt, he could dethrone the king at this games, but Bolt is such a tremendous athlete, that one will have literally the eyes of everyone on it. Michael Phelps, certainly. Phelps will not repeat his 8 gold medals in Beijing. He has dropped the 200-meter freestyle from his schedule, so he could still finish his career with 21 Olympic gold medals. And, you know, you can't even imagine that. You try to put that into any kind of perspective. He has 14 Olympic gold already, which is more than any other athlete. And in London, he'll swim 7 events. He'll be in 4 individual events and 3 relays. There's going to be another amazing story on the track, and that's South African runner Oscar Pistorius. He's the Blade Runner, as we've come to know him. He's the athlete who competes on 2 almost sort of these steel springs on his really to serve as his feet. He will be the first athlete, the first amputee athlete and Paralympian to compete in the able-bodied, if you want to call him that, Olympics. He'll run the 400 meters in the 4x400 relay. Canadian diver Emily Haymans could become the first diver in Olympic history to win medals in 4 consecutive Olympics. There is another great athlete on the track, the Russian pole vaulter, Yelena Isinbayeva. She's going to defend her championship, and she's an amazing story in herself, because if she's on, everyone else will be arriving at London fighting for the silver and the bronze. The games have grown so much, Kel. The first Olympics of the modern era in Athens in 1896, there were 245 athletes who took part from 14 nations, and they took part in 43 events. In Beijing 4 years ago, there were 10,900 athletes from 204 nations in 302 events. So the British are ready for this. They are pretty much organized and set and ready to go. The test events have been done. They have 4,700 medals that will be presented to athletes, and they are being stored in the vaults at the Tower of London. So it gives you some idea, you know, the import that these things have. And this, I think, will be the first games, really, of the Twitter era. I think we'll see this games covered 140 characters at a time because of the immediacy and because of the fact that these are a multimedia games and the multimedia platforms. I covered my first Olympics in 1976 in Montreal using a manual typewriter and almost a primitive type of fax machine to send stories back to my community newspaper. Well, now, I mean, you're dealing with things that are done instantaneously, and that Olympic Stadium in London, I believe, at the opening ceremony will be the world's largest microwave oven. If all of London just doesn't implode based on the telecommunications that will be going on out of there, I'll be amazed.
Wow. And are you at all, I don't know what the word would be, a little anxious or, you know, just, you know, making sure you're amped and ready to go because this is going to be like the Twitter Olympics and you're going to have to be really on it, Dave?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of, I guess some of my physical preparation has been my thumbs, although I've switched from a BlackBerry to an iPhone. So I've learned the keyboard and I'm getting some new apps and I'm starting to get myself up to speed on that. But the fact was quite simple that the cost of replacing a SIM card in an iPhone was going to be remarkably less expensive than doing the same thing with a BlackBerry. So we'll be traveling with all kinds of different communication devices and so on. And the most amazing thing will be if you can actually disappear for 5 minutes during the course of one day of the 25 or so days that I will be in London, it will be quite a feat because people will know where to find you. Even when you're not there, they will be finding you. They'll be finding me in places that I'm going to instead of where I'm actually at.
Joining us on the show is sports columnist for the Montreal Gazette, Dave Stubbs. Make sure to follow him on Twitter at Dave_Stubbs. Now, you mentioned just a few moments ago about, you know, London being ready. What is London going to have to do to rank up there as one of the great Olympic host cities?
Well, I think, Kelly, the games have become so big now, it's almost impossible to rank these. And of course, it always used to be where the president of the International Olympic Committee would stand up and would, at every closing ceremony, say that these are the greatest games. Well, all that had really served to achieve was to insult the city before. And you know, they sort of gave up on that when the late Juan Antonio Samaranch stood up at Atlanta, and Atlanta was, of the games that I've done, I mean, I don't think anyone in Atlanta really wanted the Olympics there, and they kind of got them by default for the Centennial Games in 1996, and it was just a fiasco in so many different ways. Samaranch got up at the closing ceremony and called these an exceptional games, and even that, I mean, people said, oh my God, he called them exceptional, exceptional in a good or a bad way. I think what London has to do is they just have to deliver a safe and they have to deliver a predictable games, if you will. That is, they will have to provide the necessary services. They will have to make sure the transportation works. In Atlanta, there were buses that just didn't show up and athletes were missing weigh-ins and were actually missing their events because the games transport wasn't working. So, you know, London seems to have all of that in hand. They know what they need to do, and they've been working on this for a long time. So it's not as though they've been preparing overnight for this. But the enormity of the games now, if you go to London at all or you're anywhere near there 6 months before or even 3 months after the Olympics, you're not going to see London as people would normally see it. Once a city is awarded the Olympics and they start to actually button the place down and they start to get the razor wire and the security and the one ways and everything else that they have to do to protect the athletes and protect the population who go, this is not the Olympic city that you would know, or it's not the city that you would know it to be. There have been many places where I've wanted to go back to and say, I'd love to see this when it's not holding the Olympics. But London is a world-class city, there's no question. They've done a lot of different things. They've had the Olympics before. And I think the people now are warming to it. Brits traditionally have been sort of, you know, turning their noses up at this, saying this is just going to be one massive inconvenience. But experience has taught me that once the games are there and once the world arrives, there is a certain pride that the population takes, and they move heaven and earth to make sure that everything is done to put on a successful games.
Now, security is going to be intense, just like you mentioned. Is there any fear on your end for your personal safety? Do you think anything's going to happen? I know this seems like a prime target for terrorist groups.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what the Olympics have become, too. That's one of the concerns. I believe that in Beijing, they spent something like $1 billion on security. It was just off the charts. And I suppose if there is one wingnut out there who wants to make a statement, the Olympics are a place to do it. There was one guy who detonated a knapsack in Centennial Olympic Park in 1996. I believe 100 people were injured and one person died in that. And these things happen. I mean, it can happen anywhere you go. You can have someone who can leave, you know, an explosive device in a garbage can at the local shopping mall. So no matter where you go, you just make sure that you keep your nose clean and you ride the game transportation the way you do, and you just keep your eyes and your ears open as you do anywhere now. So, you know, they are taking care of everything. They understand, the security people understand how important it is to put on a safe games. And, you know, that is not to say that they have put up a wall here that is going to make this a totally impenetrable games. But, you know, I think that this is going to be a safe, happy experience. experience for anyone who goes. And my expectation is that when we get to the closing ceremonies on the 12th of August, we're going to have people talking about what a great event it was and how we saw some amazing performances, more than something silly that might have happened on a security front.
Can you explain to us what it feels like when you are at a major Olympic event? You know, is the air just sort of buzzing before, during, and after? And, you know, for example, I would just, again, use Michael Phelps. I'm sure it was so electric when he was going for that final, you know, eighth gold medal back in 08.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And depending on the event, too, you can have before the men's 100 meters in Beijing, I was fortunate. I was sitting literally at the finish line, and I was about six rows up from the finish line on the stadium floor. And when these guys go past you, honest to God, you cannot imagine how a human being can move that quickly, because when you see them come out of the blocks, and after three strides, they're at full speed. And to carry that speed for 100 meters, to give you an example, you go and stand on a football field or a soccer field in your local park, look down to one goalpost, stand on one goal line, and look at your stopwatch and click it to start, and then click it at less than 10 seconds, and you will then imagine that eight men have run that distance in less than the amount of time it took you to start and stop your watch. If you do it that way, and if you actually put it in the context of being able to make sense of it in your head, it makes no sense at all. And that is what the Olympics are about. It's about it's higher, stronger, faster. I mean, that's the motto of the Games, and has been since Baron Pierre de Coubertin reintroduced them in 1896. The Games are about achieving your best, and sometimes for athletes, the personal best is better for them almost than a gold medal, because they've achieved something they've never done before in their lives. And what better, you know, can you do than that on the given day? So, the anticipation and the buzz, especially before some of the big events, is absolutely amazing. And I can't imagine, if you're an athlete competing for the host country and you're introduced, to literally hear that many thousands of people cheering for you, and to know that the entire country literally is behind you as you're on a bus going from your athlete's village to your competition venue, and you're seeing signs and people are out on the streets waving to you. It's got to be an absolutely incredible thing. So even as a journalist, you go and you're a bit of the eyes and the ears of your readers and your viewers. But, you know, to go there and experience it, from my point of view, is it never gets stale and you never get blasé about it. They're an incredible event to cover, and everyone is different. Everyone has its unique moments, and everyone has moments that you remember for a lifetime.
Who or what or which country, I guess, is the question I'm asking. You know, which countries do you feel are going to dominate? I know that, you know, the U.S. always dominates in Summer Olympics.
They do. Great Britain has thrown an awful lot of money into sports development to be a strong country at this, so they will be very good. Russia, since the fall of the Soviet Union and a lot of these nations splintered off, they are not the world superpower that they used to be. So I would think that certainly the United States will be the country that you want to look at for some of the, at the top of the medals table. The thing of it is the International Olympic Committee doesn't even recognize an official medal table for the Games. That is done, though. It's freely reported on scoreboards. And again, you can even change the way you view how medals are won based on you know, the gold, silver, bronze total. Some people will say who won the Games based on the total number of medals won, but I think the better total, really, the better way to summarize it would be based on gold medals. So, I mean, I think the United States is certainly going to be up there. Great Britain, I think, could be very strong. Canada has some interesting potential in some events. Obviously, some of our strong events, I think, will do well in some rowing. Triathlon is going to be a fun event to watch again. There are lots of things. Track and field could produce medals, swimming, diving. I mean, the aquatic sports will certainly be strong for Canada. So it will be, again, it comes down to the day. It comes down to athletes who overachieve based on what they've done before, and there are athletes who have a bad day for whatever reason, and some of the great hopes just kind of fall by the wayside. And of course, that's what makes it a very human endeavor. This is supposed to happen, but the Olympic Games are not contested on paper. You've got to do it on the playing field, on the track, on the grass, in the swimming pool, on horseback. So you do it in a lot of different ways, and that's how we'll sort of watch and be entertained for a couple of weeks.
Now, you've been, you know, reporting on sports for a long time, and I wanted to ask you, especially because, you know, this is several Olympics in for you, are you ever concerned about the athletes post-Olympics? Because, you know, there's such adrenaline going on to get them there, you know, the 4 years leading up to it, or, you know, some of them have been training forever. And then, you know, there's that inevitable letdown, and I'm sure you've seen that in covering, you know, Olympians that are, you know, finish their events and maybe finish their careers. Do you have concern for them? Do you think that some of their nations don't handle their emotional well-being after it's done?
Well, some of them don't. There's no question. And, you know, a lot of these athletes now have really, really good support networks around them. They deal with sports psychologists. They're dealing not just with the chiropractors and with the massage therapists and the coaches and the people who are going to develop them physically and get them ready. But they have people who take care of the mental side of the game as well. Yeah, I can certainly speak to the post-Olympic letdown. I've come home from a number of games where you spend so much time preparing for them and you get to the closing ceremony and you wake up the next day and the Olympic flame has been extinguished and everyone is packing up and going home, and then you return home and it's back into your own life. Well, an athlete hasn't just prepared for 2 years or 4 years. For the most part, a lot of these athletes have been preparing for 6 and for 8 years because they knew they wouldn't necessarily be ready by the games that was just around the corner, but they knew they would be ready for the one beyond that. So yeah, I think it's all different. All these athletes adapt differently. A lot of them aren't prepared to even say, look, I'm going to retire at the end of this Olympics. They don't even want to think about that because it just takes the edge off what they're doing. You will often see an athlete go to the Olympics and then stick around another year, maybe go to a world championship, maybe do another World Cup, and then they decide, okay, you know, I don't think that I necessarily have the medal at this point physically and emotionally and mentally to go for another 3 or 4 years to get ready for the next games. That's when they make their decisions. But, you know, to watch the strength of these people, to see, you know, what we see literally, Kelly, will be the tip of the iceberg. We will see them compete for, what, 10, 15, 20 seconds, for maybe a half an hour, for whatever the length of their event is. But just to get there, the amount of work, the training, the competitions they have done, the number of injuries they have suffered, the number of things they have overcome, the sleepless nights, the training through cold and through flus and everything else, that's, the to me, the most amazing thing. I mean, the fact that they go there, for the most part, without a lot of financial windfall awaiting them. Yes, there are some athletes who can do very well and will be handsomely rewarded by corporate sponsors and so on afterwards. But look, these kids did not get involved in sports at the age that they started these sports because they saw a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. They got involved because they loved the sport, they loved the travel, the camaraderie, the friendships they made, and the memories that they will have for a lifetime. So that, for them, is what makes the Olympics very special. And I think anyone who is part of the Olympic family, and that goes for journalists, athletes, coaches, volunteers, the people who are selling the food at the the concession stands, they all feel the same thing. So it's a very, very special thing. And you'll all kind of, you know, slip away a little bit into a bit of a post-Olympic letdown. I'm not going to have a lot of time. I'll get home, take a few weeks off, and then I'm right back into the Montreal Canadiens, who never seem to win.
And I wanted to ask you just, you know, a final question. For people who are listening right now, do you suggest that, you know, in their lifetime, if it's possible, financially possible, that they attend an Olympics if they can get there?
Yeah, you've got to do it if you can do it. And, you know, you see, I come back from the Olympic Games and I will sometimes go and speak in schools, Kel, and the kids will say, what did you think about this event and that event? And inevitably, I turn the tables. I say, you know what? You saw a lot more of the Olympics than I did, because television can bring you to 6 or 8 different competition venues in an hour. They basically are your tour guide. They take you from here to there to the other, and you see all these different things. When you go to the Olympics, it's not even a matter of being two places at once. Sometimes you can't be one place at one time. You can't get there from here because of logistics, because of transportation. But you know what? If you go to a games and if you get tickets to go and see a couple of events, you just can't help but be moved by the excitement and the flags and the music and just, you know, the national pride. You know, when you see a kid walk out onto the pool deck or walk onto the track, and you realize that, I mean, they don't have a prayer. They're going to have their behinds kicked. But you know what? They are there, and they are there to give their best, and you can't help but feel a swelling of pride for them and for what they've done. And you watch the opening ceremonies, and you see all these different nations march into the stadium behind their flag bearer, and it's a pretty emotional event. It always is, and I'm sure as long as the games continue in their current form, that it always will be.
Dave, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
That's sports columnist for the Montreal Gazette, Dave Stubbs. Again, make sure to follow him on Twitter at Dave_Stubbs.
KellyAlexanderShow.com. Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee, and today we're talking about waiting before jumping into a relationship. Sometimes when you've been single and looking for a long while, it can be a bit of a surprise when all of a sudden a potential partner appears, full of passion and desire to start something with you right now. After trudging through the desert of loneliness, here comes this beautiful oasis of love, inspiring the temptation to just go full steam ahead and dive right in. I totally understand that urge. None of us are immune to it, but I'd like to caution you to just wait a bit longer before you enter. See if that oasis is for real or just a mirage. Now, I'm not encouraging you to be mistrustful or negative when you meet somebody new. Just take it slow enough to get a better evaluation of who they are and whether you are compatible beyond chemistry. We live in a give-it-to-me-now society where instant gratification is expected. Heck, it's demanded. So it goes a bit against the grain when you prefer to take a laid-back approach when getting to know a romantic candidate. The person may think you're not that into them since your eagerness doesn't match theirs. They may even step it up in the pursuit to win you over, trying even harder to get your approval and commitment. That will apply even more pressure for you to make a decision. The thing is, for those of us looking for a serious relationship, we don't need the song and dance. We need to see the walk and the talk, and that will take the time it needs to take. You may have thoughts of guilt when applying the brakes in another's forward motion into your life. After all, here's someone who's interested in you, and you like them too. You're just not keen on jumping in bed right away and sharing closet space just yet. And that's absolutely normal. You shouldn't feel mean about it. I think it's rare to find two people who've fallen in love at the same time with the same intensity. Everyone has to go at a pace that's comfortable for them, and no doubt our past experiences with heartbreak will influence that. But as long as you're willing to explore new possibilities, it's absolutely in your right to be cautious. If you're feeling rushed into a relationship, don't allow that fear of missing out on a good thing force you to disregard your first instinct. Take the time that's right for you to feel secure. Now, I say this a lot, but it's true. Communication is key. If you're dating someone who keeps hitting the fast forward button, let them know that you prefer to just take things mid-tempo so that you can savor the experience of getting to know them. I'll also give you one warning. It's important that you don't sleep with them in the beginning stages, because that'll throw things in a whole other level of complication. Getting intimate off the bat can cloud your judgment and will create a lot of mixed signals, so it's best to leave that until later. If things are going in the right direction, you'll get there eventually. If the person you're dealing with can't accept that, well, then maybe their priorities are not aligned with yours. Love is not something that can be rushed, nor should it be. When it's allowed to bloom in its own time, a much richer experience develops. So don't rush and don't worry. When you're ready to take that step, you'll know it.
With you, this ain't the honeymoon, past the infatuation phase, right in the thick of love. At times we get sick of love, it seems like we argue every day. I know I misbehaved and you've made your mistakes, and we both still got room left to grow. And though love sometimes hurts, I still put you first, and we'll make this thing work. But I think we should take it slow. We're just ordinary people. We don't know which way to go, 'cause we're ordinary people. Maybe we should take it slow. Take it slow. Oh, this time we'll take it slow. Take it slow. Oh, this time we'll take it slow.
This ain't a movie, no. No fairy tale conclusion, y'all. It gets more confusing every day. Sometimes it's heaven sent, then we head back to hell again. We kiss, then we make up on the way. I hang up, you call. We writhe and we fall, and we feel like just walking away. As our love advances, we take second chances. Though it's not a fantasy, I still want you to stay. We're just ordinary people. We don't know which way to go, 'cause we're ordinary people. Maybe we should take it slow.
You might still be dusting off your flip-flops and summer handbags, but the world's top designers have descended on the City of Love recently to show off their latest haute creations for fall and winter. It won't be long before we'll see cozy fall sweaters and boots creeping back into our favorite stores. This week, we welcome MTV fashion contributor and creator of A Haute Mess fashion blog, Nikki Blazina, to the show to help us get a handle on how to look our best in the cooler months. Nikki, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, Kelly.
So, Nikki, a couple of months ago, you and I talked about the hottest spring and summer styles. What trends are going to be, you know, happening for us this fall?
Fall is going to be quite a bit different from spring, to be honest. So this spring, we saw a lot of really bold prints and a lot of bright colors. And this fall is a lot more toned down. So there's still, I mean, you're still going to see a lot of monochromatic looks, like how we've been wearing head-to-toe prints this summer. We're going to see that, but more with muted colors. So there's a lot of winter white. Burgundy is going to be a really huge trend this fall, actually. All the magazines are saying burgundy is the new black, so let's pretend you heard it here first. And there's still a bit of color blocking, like, and wearing more than one color at once, aside from the monochromatic trend, but it's like wearing navy blue and black, so it's still quite muted compared to what we're seeing now.
So is it like an annual thing, Nikki, across the board where, you know, it's summer, so people are wearing these bright floral colors or, you know, ones that really pop up, and then fall, everyone sort of just goes, you know, sort of muted and stores those neon colors elsewhere?
Yeah, I think so. That's kind of the general rule of thumb. I mean, unless you're kind of in fashion, you're where you're always kind of one season ahead anyway. And that's kind of one of the first things I learned when I started going to Fashion Week in New York, is I was like, okay, like it's February, so I need to be wearing everything that's in style for spring right now. But everyone's wearing stuff for spring, summer, and next fall already, so people were wearing neon at Fashion Week like months and months and months ago, but now it's a little more mainstream, so unless you're kind of really on the ball with it, I'd say it's kind of bright color is more of a spring thing, and the darker muted colors are more of a fall thing. It just makes seasonal sense, I guess.
Now, you know, you mentioned the runway shows and all that sort of stuff. We often see these elaborate fashions, obviously, and styles coming down the runway that no one could ever possibly think they're going to wear to the office. But, you know, what is the best way, I guess, to adapt haute couture, you know, to our everyday sort of wardrobe?
It's basically just don't take everything too literally. I mean, there's stuff that comes down the runway that, like, don't get me wrong, like, fashion is art, but to a certain degree, like, it's understandable why some people look at it and laugh, because they're just like, no one would ever wear this in public. So it's not that you have to wear, like, a complete, like, latex suit that covers your head. It's like taking pieces of it and applying it to your wardrobe. So right now at Couture Week in Paris, there's a lot of kind of head-to-toe, like, beautiful lace gowns. And, I mean, none of us are going to be wearing a couture gown in our daily lives, but it's looking at the material and saying, okay, like, lace is a big trend right now. How can I incorporate this into my wardrobe? So maybe do, like, a lace blouse or a lace cocktail dress.
Gotcha. Okay, so that you're sort of looking at the materials, like you said, and then implementing that into your own life.
Yeah, it's you never take anything on the runway too literally.
Mm-hmm.
Especially just for your everyday life. I mean, you can, and that's awesome. I always encourage that. Like, if you want to wear something straight off a runway, sweet, do it. But for the majority of us, I would say just kind of looking at different themes on the runway and applying those versus the actual pieces themselves.
Okay. Joining us is fashion expert and blogger Nikki Blazina. Again, make sure to check out her blog, ahautemess.ca. Now, Nikki, for those of us who are, I guess, a little bit timid about fashion, what's your advice for branching out and sprucing up the wardrobe this fall? Is it trying new colors or trying new ways of wearing things?
I would say color is kind of a huge, if you want to try a trend, I would say color is a really easy way to do it. So, I mean, as I said, like, you're seeing a lot of kind of burgundy and winter white and those monochromatic looks. So I'd say try a nice tailored burgundy pantsuit versus your basic black, or try get a winter white coat instead of a black coat. Stuff like that would be a really easy way to kind of upgrade for fall. The great thing actually about this fall is that a lot of the pieces are kind of vintage inspired and some of the trends we've seen before. So there's a lot of kind of military-inspired looks that have come back this fall, and we've kind of seen this the past few seasons already. So this is kind of a great time to go vintage or thrift shopping to look for kind of cool pieces, like unique pieces like that. Also with fur, fur is such an easy way to kind of elevate an outfit and make it look really chic. So I always say get vintage fur. Don't kill any animals for your wardrobe, please. But if it's already dead, why not? So, yeah, vintage fur is really great. You can get a wonderful vintage, great quality coats, fur coats, at basically any vintage store. They're always there. So that's kind of a unique way to elevate a look, I would say.
With regards to this winter white that you're talking about, does that rule of thumb ever, or does it still apply for that white after Labor Day thing? Because I really never understood that. And do people even still mention it?
I think they do. I think people still definitely keep it in mind, but I don't see why. I mean, honestly, my attitude is always wear whatever you want, and if you look stupid, you'll know if you look stupid. We're all smart people. We have good judgment here, and I think wearing, like, a white T-shirt instead of a cream T-shirt after Labor Day, I mean, give me a break. You can do it.
Well, I guess it applies to if you're, you know, still trying to wear your yacht uniform from June. You know what I mean? I don't think any of us are still trying to wear, you know, Dex shoes and white, you know, little caps and whatever else going on into October. So I think you're right. I think white is still an option. It just depends what type of clothing you're wearing.
Yeah, just use your judgment. Like, don't wear a pair of white jeans and a navy and white striped shirt and look like you're about to go boating in November or October, right? So.
Right. Okay. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit again about some summer clothes and the fact that I think a lot of us get so excited in the summer because we can be a little bit more daring, I guess, and we get latched on to certain summer, you know, shorts or capris or whatever it is. Are there any styles of fabrics that we can sort of carry over from the summer months into fall, or are we sort of have to put it in our head, we're done with that and move into autumn?
There are definite fabrics that you don't want to be bringing into fall. So, I mean, like stuff like linen, and that's a very summer fabric. So I wouldn't suggest wearing that this fall. But, I mean, denim is huge right now. There are so many different unique colors and prints and different cuts of denim. And I think you can all wear denim year round, which is great. What else can you wear right now? I'm trying to think, like, I'm such in the mindset of just like tank tops and denim shorts right now.
Well, I think the linen comment was really great, because I think that is something to keep in mind, that you shouldn't, that is, I think linen, if I sort of take a third person look at that, that is summer. And if you wear that in October, you are stupid.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to Florida, you know what I mean? Or something
like
that.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely a vacation. Save that for your vacations and for the warmer weather months. And it's, I mean, it just makes sense too. Like, it not only looks very summery, but linen wrinkles like crazy. So if you're wearing it with your layered clothing to stay warm, I mean, it's just going to look terrible anyway.
Right. Now, when we talk about the cooler weather months and such, is there something that we should have in our closets at all times as like a go-to? Is that denim? I don't know.
Always have a pair of jeans that you love to wear, just one pair that looks awesome and you feel really comfortable in, because if you're not feeling very sartorially inspired, jeans is where you go.
Okay.
I like to do a printed denim. Like, I have a cool pair of like kind of khaki and green, they sound terrible actually out loud, but they're feather printed denim. And I love them, and they were good this spring, and they'll also carry into fall. So if you're looking for printed denim right now, which is a big spring trend, start thinking about kind of darker colors and stuff you'll be able to wear this fall as well, because that's a really easy way to just kind of punch up an outfit and make it look cooler than it is, even if it's just a t-shirt and jeans. Other fall essentials that you'll need, I think a good leather jacket, like a nice motorcycle jacket, is always a good essential to have, just because you can wear that over a dress, or you can wear it with jeans and a t-shirt, and it always kind of makes you look a little edgier and a little cooler, and it will go with everything, which is good. And just like a nice, like a classic trench coat or a classic wool coat for fall.
Okay.
Because we live in Canada and we need to stay warm.
Fantastic. Now, I wanted to speak to you a little bit about celebrities, because I think that, and I'm sure you would think this as well, celebrities do play a role in what everyday fashion is, because I think a lot of us get ideas from, you know, whomever. And, you know, even I think younger ladies, they get, you know, super inspired by maybe female artists that are being daring, for example, like Katy Perry. Now, I don't think anyone is going to go wear bubblegum, you know, shoes or something like that. But I think, you know, Katy Perry does inspire people. And when it comes to that, what celebrities do you actually look up to or look for in recent times as somebody that people are following trend-wise?
I'm a little bit jaded when it comes to the whole celebrity style thing, just knowing how the behind the scenes of this all works. I know that a lot of it is just a stylist dressing, and a lot of it is a fashion house just gifting the celebrity with clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think there are a lot of really well-dressed celebrities, but I do think they get a bit of unnecessary credit. Having worked in fashion, so I'm always like, oh, give the stylist some credit. Like, they work so hard, and the celebrity is the one that everyone thinks is cool.
Right. Yeah. And actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because it really is the stylist, I think. I mean, I think certain celebrities have to obviously be okay with wearing, you know, the Ziploc bag or whatever they're going to come up with. But
yeah,
it obviously is their fashion forward, you know, stylist being creative.
Yeah, definitely. And there are celebrities that are kind of known for not using stylists. I know Blake Lively kind of gets a lot of attention for that, but I don't really find her style particularly interesting. But I think Diane Kruger, for example, she did the entire film festival in Paris, or in Cannes, and she didn't use a stylist the whole time, and she looked amazing. So I think she's a celebrity that always kind of, she's always on trend, but she never looks outrageous. She always, like, she just looks very fashion forward, very chic, very on trend all the time. So she's a celebrity, I would say. In terms of style, she kind of hits the nail on the head.
Would you say Princess Kate falls into that as well? Princess Catherine? Duchess Catherine, whatever her name is now?
I know. I'm always like, do I call her like Duchess of Cambridge?
Yeah, I just want to call her Kate. So for our purposes, we'll call her Kate, William's wife. How does she roll? I think she's done a fine job.
She does. I think she dresses really well for what she's allowed to do. Like, I would love to, she's basically as a body of a model. Like, she's tiny and she's gorgeous. Like, she could be wearing anything, but I don't think her position allows her to. So, I mean, I'd love to see her in a pair of, like, drop crotch pants and a leather jacket or something, just completely not what she wears now. But I think she, in terms of what she can wear for her position, she always looks very well put together. She always looks good. And I think she kind of sets a good example for people as to how to kind of dress yourself and present yourself well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of young girls that really look up to her. So I'd rather have them looking up to her than looking at someone like Katy Perry, for example.
Right. And
no
speaking
cupcake
of,
bras.
Yeah,
for
no
everyone.
Cupcake bras. And speaking of Kate, for example, I guess just an example of what you're talking about is the fact that her engagement dress, I think, sold like crazy knockoffs of that after she announced her engagement back in 2010.
Yeah. So like her influence is incredible. And the fact that she presents herself so well and is always so well put together, I mean, that's great. That's the type of person we want to be influencing people fashion-wise.
Okay.
Not like Nicki Minaj and all those.
Right, which is just, and but you
people.
Know what's funny, actually, just speaking of the Nicki Minaj for just a second, you know, being a radio announcer and such, I, you know, have to sort of keep up to date with what she's doing, and as well as a lot of other artists. And it's funny because when I look back and see pictures of her before she decided to start wearing the crazy hair, I don't think a lot of people were really paying attention to her. And now that she's got this crazy out there style, that sort of mixed in with the talent that she has, she's, you know, blown up into the stratosphere.
Yeah. I think that's, I mean, that's good marketing too, right? That's developing kind of a persona and a character for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm sure people like Katy Perry and Lady Gaga and Nicki Minaj, like, well, I would hope that they would just throw on a pair of sweatpants from time to time.
Right.
And just chill out. But, I mean, I do think that, I think the character is very intriguing, but in terms of actually being a fashion and, I think, well, there's a difference between a fashion and style icon. If they're going to be a style icon, then I really don't think that people should be wearing full latex dresses or...
Right. If you were to look at like celebrities that. From, you know, maybe the 90s and the 2000s that are still going strong, but now, you know, these ladies are in their 40s and 50s, what do you think of them? Do you think they're sort of good ambassadors for people sort of, you know, heading into their 40s and 50s? Like if I bring up names like Janet Jackson or Julia Roberts or, you know, even Whitney Houston before she passed away.
I think so. I think that's a really good point. Like people can look at certain celebrities. I mean, you kind of age with like your favorite celebrities as well. So when you see them and how they kind of dress for their age, I think it is good to kind of look at that. And if you're kind of in the same age range, I mean, not every woman in their 40s is going to look like Jennifer Aniston because she basically looks insane.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Insanely good. And like Courtney Cox, for example. But at the same time, like they still do dress well for their age. They never look like they're showing too much. They never look inappropriate or vulgar. So... And you look at women like Helen Mirren in their 60s and Meryl Streep, like they both always kind of hit the nail on the head as well. Like they know how to dress for their age, and I think they do set a really good example. Because it's hard as you get older to kind of it does seem like fashion. A lot of fashion can be kind of tailored to a younger audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think having people like that is really important.
Now I wanted
really helpful, at least.
Okay. Now I wanted to talk as well about you for a second and the fact that, you know, when we read what you've got going on with your blog outmess.ca and just even obviously in our conversation right now, you obviously have a good sense of humor about what you do, even though obviously I know you take your job seriously, but what role does, I guess, a sense of humor play in fashion?
I think you have to have one. Like I said, like there's stuff that walks, that like goes down the runway and you just have to look at it and just say, what the hell is this? But, I mean, my kind of whole, I guess, not shtick. I mean, I'm kind of just a very sarcastic person in general. So I think that's what comes out in my writing. And I know, like, I just put a post up, I think, yesterday. And I wore, like, a floral blouse and matching floral shorts. And I was walking down the street. And I literally heard two guys laugh at me and ask themselves what the hell I was wearing. And I wrote about it because I was just like, you know what? This does happen. And it happens to the best of us. But... you just have to have a sense of humor about it and not care. Like, just wear what you want. And fashion, like, the whole thing is that fashion is fun. Like, there are definitely people in fashion who are very serious and try and keep that whole, like, snobby fashion person persona up. But it's unnecessary. It's fun.
And before I let you go, I guess, you know, as we do march towards fall and winter, which people don't want to hear me say, but I'm going to say it anyways, you know, whose fall and winter collections are you sort of looking forward to seeing?
I loved seeing Elizabeth and James. Like, they did their fall presentation in February in New York, and I absolutely loved their collection. I think they nailed their, it's a line designed by the Olsen twins, actually. I'm not sure how much design they actually do, but their name is behind it, and I know that they are fairly hands-on with the line, and they just did such a good job. Like, they nailed every single trend. The outerwear is amazing. The suiting is beautiful, and I think people will really like that line.
Nikki, and what's a final piece of advice for people as we launch towards autumn?
Enjoy this weather while you can.
Okay.
It's just like, if we just got summer weather, we had a really great May in Vancouver and June was terrible. So now we actually have some sun.
Okay.
So I would say just enjoy it while you can and get all that spring shopping you did, use it now.
Fantastic. Well, Nikki, thank you so much for your time again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's fashion expert and blogger Nikki Blazina. Again, make sure to check out her blog at oatmess.ca.
Bring on the remix.
When you look so wrong, my-
That's Demi Lovato with Give Your Heart a Break, the Alias radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big thank you, as always, to my guests. This week, Dave Stubbs, Nikki Blazina, and our contributor, Gina Lee with The Love Zone. Now, I always like to leave you with an inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Ernest Newman. Don't waste time waiting for inspiration. The great composer does not set to work because he is inspired, but becomes inspired because he is working. Now I have some fantastic news. We are so excited, all of us here on The Kelly Alexander Show, to let you know that we have finally launched our brand new website, kellyalexandershow.com. Please go and check it out. It's brand new, lots of features. You can grab all the podcasts, you can see blog posts, as well as see all of our team members and our contributors. We're really proud of it, and we'd love for you to let us know what you think. You can send us an email, info@kellyalexandershow.com. We also want to let you know about our new Twitter account, K Alexander Show. Please check us out on Twitter. We'd love to have you follow us along. And as always, you can find us on Facebook, The Kelly Alexander Show. Now, next week, get ready for a really compelling guest. Identity theft expert Robert Siciliano is going to talk to us about how you can protect yourself and your personal information when it comes to using laptops, desktops, as well as mobile devices. So many people use their mobile devices now to do banking and all sorts of stuff where your personal information is out there. And he has lots of great tips to make sure that you are safe. So that pretty much does it for me. If you have any comments or questions, again, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com or info@kellyalexandershow.com, and you and I'll chat soon.